And we're back with an all-new episode of Keep It. I'm Ira Madison III.
I'm Louis Fertel. I was looking at the cast list for Barbie, and I think it will turn out we are in this movie, based on everybody I'm seeing. The Barbie posters have come out. There are 24 of them. People I completely forgot were in the movie are in this movie. Emerald Fennell is a pregnant Barbie. Dua Lipa is a blue-haired mermaid Barbie. Though I have to tell you, I think there's only one A-plus Barbie in this stack, A-plus Barbie poster, and it is Issa Rae. Because this is what I thought the movie was going to be. She has a plasticine smile on. It says, this Barbie is president. And then she's wearing a sash that says president. Okay, satire. I'm there. Let's do it. Oscar Wilde. Whatever. But the main slogan for the movie is, she's everything, he's just Ken, referring to Margot Robbie as Barbie and Ryan Gosling as Ken. And I don't know what that means. Is that like a dig at Ken's identity? Are we exploring the, you know, dramaturgical beginnings of Ken? I want to know.
It means women are everything.
Okay? Ah, as you know, I disagree.
Okay, they are everything. They are the sun. They are risen up from the earth.
What is this Jill Scott Heron poem you're doing?
Some of the Barbies are very goofy. Dua Lipa as a mermaid Barbie, though, is maybe going to be everything for me.
Yeah, right. Some of these just feel like they set up a PR photo booth and people ran in and got photos. Like Michael Cera. I agree that's Michael Cera. He doesn't look Barbie ready for this movie. But again, we don't really know what is going on plot-wise here. So it actually, they do a good job teasing what will be, I'm sure, a surreal experience.
I will say, I'm very happy for my friend Scott Evans, whose poster I would say is very cute. You guessed it, he's a Ken, is at least a funny way to write Ken. And he's just got like a tank top and a cowboy hat on.
And also, knowing Scott Evans, it's going to be a gay Ken. So as opposed to these sort of teasing it gayness things that are going on with the other posters, we have one who I'm sure is legitimately gay. No, also, seeing Scott Evans, I immediately think, oh, is this a poster for a dodgeball meetup in West Hollywood? No, it's a legitimate film.
I also want to give a shout out to Hari Neff's poster. Less so the poster, which is fun, like all the other ones, but she put a post online about how, you know, trans women, you know, going back to the ballroom community, refer to themselves as the dolls. And so how important being in this movie was for her, you know, like Barbie's the ultimate doll. But about how what it looked like she wouldn't be able to do the film because of a scheduling issue when she was cast in it. She wrote like a note to Greta Gerwig about the importance of being in this film for her. And she reposted that today along with her poster. So I thought that was very lovely. But then there's the teaser trailer, which just dropped. And I think it's really cute. I like that it went straight for kitsch.
Yes, it's very the Brady Bunch movie vibes, which is we are aware of what the source material is, and we are going to hit this parody extremely hard and with the widest pupils you've ever seen. So that is very encouraging. Ryan Gosling going for broke. There is a gay entendre pun at the end of the trailer that I don't know that I'm obsessed with that Simu Liu is leaning into, but you also got Kingsley Benadire, who is extremely good looking. And I haven't seen much of him since One Night in Miami. Apparently he's going to be on an Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. show or something, which means I will not see more of him in the future.
I had forgotten that he was in this movie, and I was shocked when he was one of the initial posters that dropped. He's so cute, and I probably will see him
in
Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D.
Kate McKinnon's in this. She plays a Barbie who does the splits a lot. All right. Also, Greta Gerwig, I think, is one of the few celebrities whom I've not heard even a dubious word about. She's obviously just a brilliant writer. Someone who's probably, you know, it seems like someone who might have been bored with what she was offered actor-wise, and now she's creating this stuff that's all fabulous right down the line.
There's one red flag. She's married to Noah Baumbach.
Ah, that's right. Yes, I remember now. Though that said, I think we talked about I watched Mistress America recently. So good. That's like a very underrated 2010s movie, and she gives a sterling performance in it. One of those movies where it could go awry because she's supposed to be saying something kind of quirky at any given moment, but she there really is like a weird, believable kind of daffiness to the character that really works.
Mm. Anyway, I'm joking. I obviously do love Noah Baumbach. I'm Squid in the Whale Hive.
Oh, please. No, that's the movie that makes you understand Jesse Eisenberg.
Yeah. I'm just so angry I had to watch White Noise. So
right. Oh, yeah, I see. You're still
that's
better.
That's about it.
Wait, can I say something else about Dolls that I just thought about? I just thought about this now. Sorry, I'm popping off. Do you know what album I listened to straight through the other day? PCD by Pussycat Dolls. That what we think about the album Teenage Dream should be thought about PCD. Every track, bangerinis.
Listen, the Pussycat Dolls were the ultimate Dolls. PCD is maybe my second favorite, to be honest. I prefer Doll Domination.
Well, there's only two, so, I mean, you're saying it's their worst. It's fine. Doll Domination has I Hate This Part and When I Grow Up. I don't know if it has anything else.
It has Bottle Pop. It has
That's
What
all right.
You Think About That. It has Taken Over the World, Who's Gonna Love You, Magic, Halo, In Person, Whatchamacallit.
Okay, just gonna name all the tracks. Great.
It has a cover of that Jane Child song, Don't Wanna Fall in Love.
Jane Child, one of my favorite nose-chained performers of all time.
Speaking of, and one last tangent before we start, you said the word quirky, and it reminded me, do you know there's still people on dating apps who refer to themselves as adorkable?
What the fuck? Are they 2011 Fox employees?
You forget that, like, words like that get introduced into the lexicon, like, they really stick with some people, and they're like, you know what? I'm going to describe myself like they described Jess in New Girl.
Right. Also, I think that's a word where you're not allowed to describe yourself with it. I think it has to come from something else, somebody else. It's like camp. Like, if you're calling yourself camp, then you're doing it on purpose, and what are we even doing?
That's fair. Also, who would call themselves adorable in person? Or maybe I would. I don't want to be rude.
I'm adorable. I'm here. Yeah, not ready to make friends or not here to make friends or whatever. I'd say that.
Anyway, we have a fun episode this week.
I actually can't believe the episode that's coming up. I'm like clutching my head.
We have an actual icon here with us this week. And I know we say that all the time.
Right.
But we're not talking about, like, you know, some off the street icon. Okay. This is
icon.
She's been in it. Okay.
No, there are, you know, actors we love. Then there's, you know, esteemed actors. And then there's a very rare class of people I would call goddesses. And this is one of those people.
Yes. We have the wonderful Rachel Weisz here.
Guys, can you believe Rachel Weisz is on this show? She shouldn't even be looking at us. What is going on? It's not right. I feel bad for her. And to celebrate Rachel Weisz, we're doing a whole segment about blind spots in her catalog. Ira watched a little movie she did called The Constant Gardener, which she stomped to victory at the Oscars that year with that performance. And I watched About a Boy, which I had never seen before. And let me just say about it.
I cannot believe.
Isn't that weird? And because I fucking love Hugh Grant. I love actors who, they do their one thing and you better fucking like it. And here he is being a bastard yet again. Something about that movie I didn't realize. So Peter Hedges is one of the writers of that movie, Oscar nominated, mm-hmm. who's the father of Lucas Hedges. And then also Paul and Craig Weitz, who are acclaimed in many respects. They are the sons of Susan Conner. Do you know who that is?
I do know that name.
Susan Conner was Oscar nominated for the Douglas Sirk Imitation of Life. She plays the mixed race daughter in that movie who has kind of a breakdown. Very unusual role in the 1950s.
Mama! Yeah. Mama, I'm black now. Yeah. I love you. Sobbing at the casket. That is a classic. Okay?
I love that fucking movie. Please. All right, Juanita Moore, that would have been a great win. Yeah.
By the way, internet, that's what passing looks like. Okay. There's been a lot of stupid conversation from people who denotes like white passing or not. And someone referred to Halle Berry And I was like, baby, Halle Berry is not crying on a casket because she denied her black mother her entire life. Okay.
You're saying that happens a lot. Okay, great. I just saw, I mean, by the
it
way,
it happened to me last week.
Oh, okay. I saw footage of Halle Berry at a drag brunch in West Hollywood, fully like MTV's The Grind, grinding on some drag queen last week. I had never seen anything like it.
She always seems like one of the most fun celebrities.
Yeah. No, I think there's a very talkative vibe about her. Yeah, right. Exactly. No.
Dorothy Dandridge has been introduced and she's sticking around. Yes.
She's playing bingo with the queens.
And then we're also going to discuss what we've been watching. And unfortunately, it hasn't been anything good.
This is that one of those weird, it's that weird time of year where like there's not too many esteemed movies coming out. Like next week we get the Super Mario movie and at least there's a lot of hype about that, so we'll probably talk about that. Mm-hmm. But there's just not much in the realm of, I mean, I know you love Succession, we'll probably talk about that, but there's just not a lot going on that I care about right now.
Mm. Well, we'll get into all of that and more when we're back with more Keep It. Get ready to be transported back to 1973 New York City. No, I'm not talking about one of Lewis's old movie references. I'm talking about Stiffed, the new podcast from Crooked Media and iHeartRadio. In this 8-part series, host Jennifer Romolini takes you on a wild ride through the rise and fall of Viva, the erotic magazine for women started by Porn King publisher Bob Guccione that rocked the publishing world.
With a team of feminist writers and editors behind it, Viva, in its original form, had full frontal male nudity, imagine, a fashion section run by Anna Wintour, and cover stars like Bianca Jagger. But were they doomed to fail from the beginning? Check out the first 2 episodes of Stiffed right now. Listen for free on your favorite podcast platform.
All right, Lewis, I went into Criterion this weekend.
Oh, sure.
And I watched 2 of the most important movies of our time.
Okay. Judging by the way you said that, you're lying. But I can't wait to hear what they are.
You know what I'm setting you up for nonsense. I watched Murder Mystery and Murder Mystery 2.
Oh, right. So you're exploring the chemistry between Adam Sandler and Jennifer Aniston. And what did you come up with?
Let me tell you something. You could rub 2 sticks together and you would get more chemistry than Adam Sandler and Jennifer Aniston have on screen.
Not that I can think of any screen pairing he's had that was rife with chemistry. Maybe Emily Watson in Punch Drunk Love. I'm trying to think. But certainly, you know.
Drew Barrymore in 51st Dates. I would argue they have a fun chemistry.
Yeah.
This is the epitome of hot actress married to comedian,
which is an affliction, you know, that occurs sometimes. Yeah,
it is a thing that occurs. It is a thing that occurs. Famous comedian, though, you know, it never makes sense in the world that they're depicting.
Got it.
Because in this world, Adam Sandler is a NYPD cop. Love them, and Jennifer Aniston is a hairdresser.
Oh, not this. That's very like the next best thing, where Madonna lives in a $25 million house and she teaches yoga.
And actually, they could very well be from Chicago and not New York. I have no idea.
Whatever.
I digested both of
part
these
of the
movies.
Mystery. Yes.
I digested both of these movies this weekend and I remember very little about them. But here's the thing. Jennifer Aniston was, you know, talking her shit this weekend in a latest interview. Where she did that thing where people bemoan cancel culture that hasn't actually happened to them.
Oh, sure.
And she was talking about how you can't even, you couldn't make friends now.
Not this
because
again.
Because people are talking about how offensive it is online. And my question is, who is talking about friends being offensive online? Like, who is taking time out of their day to write, friends, man, here's all the offensive jokes in it. I feel like the one thing that people just always say is, there's a lot of white people in this show.
Right.
And that's about it. But also, they were saying there's a lot of white people in Friends in like 1995. So
Correct.
You've heard this before.
Also, first of all, just Jennifer Aniston, if she literally is bemoaning cancel culture, again, tell me the person who was canceled that you're upset about. These people never do that, because what they're skirting is having to name somebody who was unjustly criticized, and then that never happens. Anyway, secondly, I feel like all we do is try to remake Friends. Like, every comedy is like, here are these hot people hanging out. You couldn't make Friends today. It's all we do.
Anyway, just like Ray Charles, I had Aniston on my mind. And so
what? Okay.
And so
that's how
I
that song goes. Sure. Yeah.
So this weekend I was hungover and I logged on to Netflix, and truly I was met with 1,000 ads for Murder Mystery 2. And in every other category on Netflix, they were pimping the original Murder Mystery for me to watch.
As if Agatha Christie wrote it herself. By the way, you would think I would really jump on these movies, as they're like whodunits, right? Can you solve them along with Adam Sandler?
No.
Oh, that is upsetting. What am I doing?
Yeah. Here's the thing. There's a few characters, and you can sort of figure out who did it. It's very obvious who did it in the second film. The first film, it's very obvious who one of the culprits is. There's two culprits in the first film. But they're more capers than they are whodunits. Because what happens is, someone gets, like in the first movie, they're going on their honeymoon 15 years later. Because they never had time to, and he's broke. And I'm still wondering why she's married to this man. But anyway, 15 years later, they go to Europe on a vacation. And while they're on a plane, they meet Luke Evans, who's the son of this billionaire. And he invites them on his yacht for the weekend. And
okay,
then
great.
The billionaire gets murdered. And then they get framed for the murder. And basically, they're being chased through Monaco, trying to solve the murder as a killer is trying to murder them.
I have absolutely no problem with this so far.
Yeah. The problem is, you're not really figuring out who it is. It's mostly just Adam Sandler and Jennifer Aniston running through the streets.
Got it.
Being chased. You know, there's no real sort of investigation element. And then at the end, there's a whole, well, we know who did it moment. That is kind of fun. And listen, the movie is not good, but it's not amazing. It's just sort of there.
I'm sort of digging the romancing the stone vibe of the movie, though. You know, it's like, oh, they have to swing across some vines because, you know, we're falling in love and they're after us. That's sort of fun.
The jokes are kind of abysmal, and there's like, they don't have the chemistry.
Yes, comedy.
So it's sort of just there. But I will say that Murder Mystery 2 sort of just ignores the fact that you even are trying to solve a mystery. And it's just pure fun. So I would say that Murder Mystery 2 is actually quite enjoyable.
Wow, I'm shocked by this development. To defend Murder Mystery 2, I've never felt lower on Keep It, and yet here we are. a sort of caper. Do you know what I watched over the weekend I'd never seen before? You ever seen Married to the Mob?
Yes.
Oh, my God.
Michelle Pfeiffer?
A star performance from Michelle Pfeiffer. I can't believe I've never seen this movie. First of all, it explains the beginnings of Mercedes Rule, who will win a supporting actress Oscar a few years later. Very important. But otherwise, do you know what else I didn't understand about this movie? Look, I think, speaking of Margot Robbie in the Barbie movie, Margot Robbie in Babylon, did she crib Michelle Pfeiffer's performance in Married to the Mob? It's like the same thing and the same look.
And the voice.
Yeah, no, very shocking. Again, it's a movie that takes place in the 30s, and she seems like she's dressed and sounds like a Madonna wannabe in Babylon. Very baffling. Anyway, I had never seen this movie. Dean Stockwell, former child star, Oscar nominated in this movie too. Great. Also,
David
Matthew
Byrne
Modine.
Did the music.
Yeah, David Byrne did the music. Matthew Modine, who, you know, is here and there and stuff, but he's one of these James Spader-y 80s actors that I feel like has been largely lost to time. Really good in it too. I was really impressed with this movie. I thought it was fun and like unpretentious and also eye popping. Every actor is dressed to the nines in it, since, you know, it's a gaudy mob movie.
I cannot remember which play he was in for the life of me, but I did interview Matthew Modine from our college newspaper when I went to Loyola Chicago.
Oh, how nice. I could not land a single great interview when I was in college. I interviewed Paula Poundstone when I worked for the Daily Iowan, and otherwise, and Dan Savage, who was still Seattle sex columnist at the time. Otherwise, no one would talk to me. And can you imagine? They were like, Iowa City, not sure that's real.
You, an intrepid reporter, just trying to make something happen.
That's right. Oh, no, please. And that, that same summer, I went to, or between my junior and senior year, I went to Los Angeles, interned for The Advocate, and I just emailed Perez Hilton out of the blue, who was very popular at the time, and I was like, can I tail you for a second? And he said yes, and then I went to a party with him, and I was kicked out for not having the proper credentials. So that's the kind of reporter I came. I just sucked.
He set you up?
That's right, yes. I was kicked out of this event that was a Tory Spelling PR moment because they were kind of friends at the time. I had taken a bus to Malibu. I meant the indignity.
Well, to be fair, Tory Spelling probably took a bus to Malibu to go to their own event.
The stars, they're just like us, unfortunately. I haven't thought about that in a long time, but a crazy... Anyway, also, something I have watched that's come out in the past year... Daisy Jones and the Six. Okay, this show is allegedly made for me. Too generic. It feels
the
like
music
a photo
is not good.
And the music is not good either. Even though I love Riley Keough, I've said this before, the greatest gap in talent between granddaughter and grandfather in terms of acting ability is Riley Keough and Elvis Presley. It makes no sense that she is as good as she is. Elvis would be out acted by Anne Margaret, who, by the way, was not even a good actor yet. And all of those movies. And Shelley Fabaret and Mary Tyler Moore, that one time she played a nun. The movie was called Change of Habit. Don't watch it.
Mm. All right. Was it a precursor to The Flying Nun?
Flying Nun would have been contemporaneous, so they would have been competing.
Okay. A lot of nuns going on in that period.
And yet not as good as The Nun Story with Audrey Hepburn. Recommended, 1959.
Okay.
One of my favorites of hers.
I don't particularly love Daisy Jones, to be honest, but, you know, I've been, you brought it up. I've been enjoying Succession, by the way. And I will say that my problems of last year are gone.
Which is?
I really thought that they were sort of like spinning in place in season three and not a lot was happening to change the dynamics. But the dynamics have like completely blown up in the second episode of the fourth season here. And I feel like it really is ramping up to a conclusion. And I'm excited that we're in this era of shows getting to have conclusions again, since everything sort of just either goes on for too fucking long or it gets cut viciously before it's supposed to end. But I will say HBO seems to be the one place that has always done this ever since we've been watching HBO shows.
Mm. Can I voice a complaint about Succession? I watched the last episode, and I am not caught up. I had no business watching this episode. Some of the humor on this show runs a little repetitive to me. Like one character says something, and then somebody responds with, how about anything else? Or, did you really just say that? That sort of stuff. And it's like, we had like a million seasons of Veep. We're done with that now. We need to advance beyond like sardonic bastardliness.
Well, I mean, the British are sardonically bastards.
Okay, but they're not British on this show.
True, but the creator, Jesse Armstrong, is British.
All right, yeah. Just I feel like the Kieran Culkin character is a little repetitive. But Matthew McFadyen remains one of my favorite actors, and the Pride and Prejudice from the 90s, his performance is an all-timer. So
I feel like the writing and dialogue for me is really sort of some of the best on TV. I just love the wordplay. I love watching smart people on TV again.
No, generally speaking, I do support it. Also, Sarah Snook, I mean, we need to have like a full caucus one day about unclockable Australian accents, because her real life accent is full kookaburra. And then on this show, she is so convincingly American. It's disturbing. Why are they so good at this?
Well, you know, they spend all their time trying to escape the prisoner, the island.
Oh, sure.
From the prisoner. That's what I feel like Australia is. It's the island from the prisoner. And so what else are they going to do?
Did you know that Australia got rid of their national anthem and now it's just Vibes? Isn't that crazy?
I love that.
It's great.
We should do the same thing. At soccer games,
someone just says just Vibes and they just stand for a second and then then the game commences.
We should replace ours with that Lil Uzi song, I Wanna Rock.
I think it should be When I Grow Up by Pussycat Dolls, now that you mention
it. Okay. America's been growing up for a while, Lewis. When's it going to get there?
Right. Great thought. You should write that for salon.com.
I'm going to send it to Positive America. I think that should be their new slogan.
Those boys always need help.
Yeah. All right. When we're back, I still can't believe it, we'll be joined by Rachel Weiss. Today's guest is a true gift to cinema.
Couldn't be truer.
She's got an Oscar.
Yes.
A BAFTA, an Olivier, and she's met an actual mummy. What more do you want from her? You can catch her next in the mesmerizing and chilling Amazon series Dead Ringers, giving us twice the vice, playing twin identical doctors. Please welcome to Keep It, Rachel Weiss.
Hello. Thank you for having me. Thank you for that lovely intro. Goodness.
I mean, thank you for this series. I was at the premiere last night, and it was amazing. Truly, truly fantastic. I've been a fan of the original Cronenberg film, and it was so nice to see this adaptation of it. Were you a fan of the original, and sort of what inspired you to step into this world?
Yes, I was a really big fan of the original. I saw it possibly when it first came out. I was a teenager, and I just never forgot it. And I think over the years, it's become such an iconic film. It just haunted me, and it stayed with me. So I one day had a daydream. I was thinking about projects to produce and develop, and I was thinking about Sisters as an interesting, like, fertile ground for drama. And I thought, oh, what if? And I said to a producer, Sue Nagel, Anna Perner, I said, what do you reckon, Dead Ringers with two female doctors? And she said, oh, that seems like a good idea. And yeah, we took it from there.
Also, I just want to talk about this movie, the original, lingers in my head too. But and of course, Jeremy Irons' performance is fantastic. Genevieve Bujold, fabulous in it. It also sticks in my head because it is wildly disturbing. Just some of the images in this movie, you have to like clutch your face and look away. It's so shocking, as you know, many Cronenberg movies have that quality. But are you comfortable with like disturbing content? It's just, to me, a crazy movie to bring back because it's so singular and how honestly gross it is.
Well, what interested me about the original film was the psychological complexity about the codependence between these brothers and how twisted that was. But also in the original film, they are having such fun in Manhattan. They're the top of their game. They're brilliant. Their careers. They always have a martini in their hand or at some party with another hot woman on their arm. And they're having a blast. And I love that mixture of the idea of professionals who are flying high in their public careers, but in their private lives, it's dysfunctional and twisted. So they're having a lot of fun until they're not. It's not all gross and twisted. There's a lot of joy too, I think.
Absolutely. But I would say what's also so interesting about, you know, the translation from Cronenberg to this version is that what becomes a lot of the, what you would say is quote unquote grotesque, is just a lot of close-ups. You know, the one particular scene in the first episode with a lot of childbirths happening, you know? And I think that is so interesting to take and just thrust right on screen because, you know, it's this mix of the miracle of life, but also, you know, showing like what women's bodies are actually going through the process. Did you feel like there was a lot of fun to be had with just sort of taking that and sort of taking it to like a sort of extreme, almost even sort of camp, but dark horror vibe. And also just the difference in having two women be the leads instead of the men. Because I will say that, you know, with Jeremy Irons, you know, having the time of his life at a fertility clinic, you know, in like the 90s, there is sort of like a very like creepy element to it being from a man's POV.
Yes, yes. Was really interesting, everything you've just said. So I'm just absorbing and trying to like, I think for the story, line, Alice Birch, the writer, creator, showrunner extraordinaire of this piece. I think for she and for me, it was very, for her and for me, it was very important to show what maternal healthcare looked like at this moment in time, because they both have these massive dreams, like crazy big dreams of completely changing the world. Beverly and Lisa Belliot, which would be the combo of them. Beverly in relation to the way in which women give birth, and Elliot in terms of the science of fertility. And they both have crazy big dreams. So before we went into the kind of more like bananas heightened operatic territory that the later episodes get into, we really wanted to make the case for, well, why are their dreams even necessary? What's wrong? What's wrong with healthcare? What's wrong with the way in which women give birth? So we showed all those stories for that purpose, to then kind of go into these into the future episodes. And in terms of the childbirth scenes in that first episode, I think Alice and I were just really interested in seeing them. It's something that neither of us had seen in stories before. It's what the twins do. They deliver babies, and Jeremy Irons's character, as you pointed out, they really work on just fertility and gynecology. Mm-hmm. So these two women deliver babies. So it's what they do every day. It's as ordinary to them as you and I speaking to each other now. Mm. We're just doing our jobs and they're just doing their jobs. So we were just interested in really just examining that from their point of view. But yeah, I agree with you. It goes into a lot of different tones that are, you know, darkly humorous, sometimes camp, to quote you.
And the second episode with the almost Sackler-esque family is really sort of like, really just like a searing satire, you know, in sort of like a Succession sort of way, where it just like really attacks a certain sect of rich, you know, people in this country.
Yes, yes. And Beverly has this very ideologically pure dream, but she agrees to take money from these Sackler-like couple family. So she has compromise. She's highly morally compromised. So there's a lot of complexities like that in this script, which are quite delightful, I think.
I'm often too busy thinking of you as a quote-unquote powerful actress that I forget that you are also a hilarious actress. I mean, just like over the years, I think of like the line readings you've given. I mean, like, it is almost painful to think about The Favorite and like how deadpan you get and how cutting you are to the Emma Stone character. It's just like scream out loud, you know, like Maggie Smith would be proud, that level of awesome deadpan humor. And I was wondering, when in your career have you felt the funniest?
First of all, thank you for the Maggie Smith shout out. That's a very big deal for a British girl, as you can imagine. When have I felt the funniest? Well, I mean, I think this is probably a really obvious thing to say, but when people are finding you funny, it doesn't feel funny to you. I think the more committed you are and serious you are, like you mentioned The Favorite. I mean, I don't even think I knew that it was funny. In fact, I didn't. So I think the more committed you are, then it can end up being funny, I think. Yeah.
Thinking about the filming of that movie, did you try a whole bunch of different ways to convey the really lacerating tone that those characters have with each other? Did it take a long time to settle on the tone? Or was it always apparent on the page how, you know, bleak the humor was, and yet also powerful altogether it is?
Well, Yorgos Lanthimos, who directed it, he would just say, "Do it faster."
Wow!
So he doesn't ever talk about the scenes or the acting or the intention. In fact, one day I said to him, "Am I doing something?" I asked him a question, and he just said, "Rachel, I'm Yorgos." And I was like, "Oh yeah, sorry, I forgot." Yeah, he just doesn't. You don't discuss things, so he'll just tell you to go faster. So how he gets that tone that you're describing is a kind of alchemical mystery to me. I don't know how he does it, but he does.
I would also say that it's so surprising too that you have so many roles that have become iconic just to queer people. Just not even from Dead Ringers, where you have a relationship with an actress in the series. But, you know, you've got Rachel McAdams, like, spitting in your mouth in Disobedience. You've got the favorite. Or maybe you spit in hers.
I spat in her mouth, yeah. Sorry. Yes,
I had it the other way around. I mean, listen, I'd take either one. So,
oh, no, maybe she spat in mine. Actually, I don't remember now. It's sorry. It's small details.
And then even The Favorite and some of your other works. I mean, you know, like, what has it felt like just having, I guess, this reception from a large part of your fan base? Do you even get, you know, sort of that you have this large fan base of a queer variety? And also, like, what goes into picking sort of roles like that for you?
Well, it's extremely flattering, what you're telling me. And I have been told it a few times, but I'm not on social media, or I'm not perhaps properly aware of it, but I'm extremely flattered. Sloppy.
No, it's like you and Kate Blanchett sort of feel like sort of our preeminent sort of actresses who do these sort of like really intense sort of roles of women who are in relationships with other women. And it's just sort of masterful work and interesting to see from both of you.
Thank you. What lovely, lovely news to get this morning in Brooklyn. You know, what came into my mind as you were speaking, as I was thinking of queer female icons, like Bette Davis came into my mind. Mm-hmm. And I remember that, and she's someone that I look up to very much as an actor. I think she's brilliant. But she was in the first Dead Ringers film. There was a 1940s black and white Dead Ringers where Bette Davis played two sisters.
Right. Yes.
Mm-hmm. They could never have them on the screen at the same time because the technology didn't exist yet, but it's really, really brilliant. And I mean, talk about campy. That is really campy. Mm. And then that is a remake of a Mexican film called Dead Ringers in Spanish. So this is a homage to an homage. So there's lots of layers of remaking.
You mentioned Bette Davis. Are you somebody who's likely to watch old movies a lot? Does that speak to you even now? I think of you as such a like definitively modern actor, you know, like in the old days, all of your lines would be delivered with a scream by somebody by like Bette Davis. But we get such a, you know, calm, assured, deadly tone from you that I feel like is very this century.
Well, thank you. And I do watch old movies. Yeah, I love Bette Davis, Ingrid Bergman, Katharine Hepburn. Yeah, I do. Yeah. I mean, Bette Davis is like, wow.
Bette Davis is one of the few celebrities I can think of where if she didn't exist, there would be like a hole in Hollywood history. Just the way she propelled through the decades, the like, I'm absolutely going to do it my way and nobody else's way. And then the amount of course, iconic roles we got from her. She has 10 Oscar nominations, I believe. And all About Eve, every time I watch it, there's some line I totally forgot about that's an A+.
Yeah, it's just the most extraordinary film. Marilyn, as you well know, you're more of a film historian than me, but Marilyn Monroe's first screen appearance, where she just has that two lines or something saying, could you get my coat or something? I don't remember what she says, but you're like, who's that?
Yeah. She has to tangle with Addison DeWitt. It's like, oh, God, you're too innocent for this, Marilyn. Stop.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Have there been any, I mean, we've gotten the chance to work with so many wonderful actors over your career. Like, have there been any people who you feel like you've had particularly sort of a great time being with on screen, or someone who you sort of like came away from the film or production being like, you learned something new about yourself as an actor just from interacting with them?
Well, I mean, there were so many actors on Dead Ringers that I that I loved working with. I mean, Jennifer Ely.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, I find her performance in Dead Ringers pretty staggeringly good because she's so, I don't want to say evil, but she has zero moral compass, shall we say. And you can't take your eyes off her. And she's just so cool and calm and collected and honest and doesn't raise her voice. And she's just the coolest cat I've ever seen. The coolest bad gal I've ever seen. I loved watching her and Emily Mead, who plays her wife. I just thought they were just the most bizarre couple. And if you watch Emily Mead, and I don't think it was in the script, I think it's just something she did. She's always drinking a glass of milk with whatever she's eating. She'll have milk when she's like a big baby. And actually, I love Emily's performance as well, because you see a highly intelligent actress kind of playing dumb. Mm-hmm. And you see like the workings of her mind behind the character. And you don't know if it's the character acting dumb or what's going on. There's so many layers there. So I love working with Jennifer and Emily, and Michael Chernus, who's Elliot's best and only friend. He was just wonderful. So I'm kind of thinking of the actors that I just worked with, but yeah, I mean, yeah, they were great. But Olivia Colman is a lot of fun.
Oh, she got what a performance.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. She's a lot of fun.
Jennifer Ely, also really good in a movie called A Quiet Passion a few years ago with Cynthia Nixon as Emily Dickinson. But yeah, must watch. Very good film.
I haven't seen that. I must see it. It's Terrence Davies, isn't it? Yeah,
yes,
he's
right.
Quite brilliant.
Obviously, Brendan Fraser, your old co-star, just won an Oscar recently. What was it like watching this like extremely triumphant moment for him just sort of ramp up out of nowhere? And he didn't win the Oscar in a walk, but he was favored to win and he won it.
Yeah. I thought his performance was so brilliant. I loved the film. I thought it was this intense operatic melodrama, and it all took place in one room, and there he is unable to move on a couch at the center of it, and the world comes to him with these four characters. I thought he was extraordinary and moving, and yeah, I sent him a text as soon as I'd seen it and just was like, that was something else. And congratulated him when he won. I mean, couldn't have happened to I know people say this all the time, it sounds like a cliche, but it really couldn't have happened to a nicer guy. He's really a proper, like, just like a sweetheart, a total sweetheart. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Obviously, you're an Oscar winner yourself. How much does the ceremony mean to you in general? Like, do you look forward to the Oscars, or do you think of it as like, you know, work in a way, you know, like the season-long campaigning, et cetera? How much of it is fun to watch or witness, and how much of it do you feel like is, I don't know, a circus or something?
Well, I think it's definitely changed over the years. It's become more, maybe more and more how you just described it. But listen, it's the biggest honor that you get as an actor from your community. So it's quite surreal. It's quite surreal to watch it live, to watch it on the television, to be there and be nominated, or then to actually win. It's so iconic, and the statue itself has such an iconic status. It's almost like you're inside a fantasy. It's so unlike anything else, and so unreal. Yeah.
Mm. One thing I really love about Dead Ringers is that you sort of get to play two characters that are very opposite of one another, and they sort of mirror what I would say are a lot of the roles that you've had before. You know, you have sort of a altruistic sort of like nicer character in something like The Constant Gardener. But then, you know, there's also you in Beautiful Creatures, you know, where you're really more of like a sort of like a morally gray character, you know, like sort of which ones do you find yourself more drawn to? Or is there any character you've played that you feel like really feels more like your personality?
Well, I don't really feel like any of my characters really, although the contradiction is like when you play them, you have to show up. So they're bits of you there probably, but it's all filtered through, or it all begins with writing. Mm-hmm. It begins with writing. So Alice wrote these two completely distinct characters on the page. They're psychologically complicated. They're, as I said, like brilliant at their jobs, but they have this highly dysfunctional, aberrant private life. They're like big babies. I mean, they don't know how to do their laundry, or they have Greta there who's making them their food, and they have a lot of contradictions to them. They're both brilliant and totally messed up. So when you get writing like that, it's just, I've never had writing as good as the writing that Alice did on the show. I think it's really exceptional. So you take away that writing, you lock the door of your study or your room where you're going to learn the line, wherever you are, and then you just start working on the lines, and they speak to your imagination, and then you just start to like cook up a character, like you know there's a recipe to cook a meal, and you start cooking it, and you start doing that in your imagination. So it's not really, I don't really have like a, I can't really say I'm Beverly. I will never choose between those twins. I love them both equally.
Speaking a bit of even that process, you know, of like locking the study, you know, like really getting into a character. Lewis and I are always interested when we have actors on who are married to other actors, you know, like, so what's it like in a process where you and then your husband, Daniel Craig, are both maybe working on a project? Do you sort of confer with one another about the projects that you're taking on? Do you sort of share like your process when you're getting into a character with one another? I mean, and he's such a fantastic sort of actor in sort of the same realm as you. I mean, I remember seeing him in Othello and really just sort of like loving that performance from him. And I just kept thinking, yeah, like, is Rachel seeing bits and pieces of this at home, you know?
No, his Iago was, that was an incredible production. And in that tiny space in downtown Manhattan, it was like, yeah, the actors, you could touch them, right? You could like,
he was delivering like a monologue, like next to my face. And it was like, so, such an intense performance.
Wow. Yeah. It was really, that was a brilliant, brilliant production. I guess the door to his, office closes when he's working on his on his characters. It's quite private. Yeah, it's not something you really share. I mean, because it's just to do with your imagination. So it's sort of, yeah, not something you can really describe. It's just like you in conversation with your daydreams, I guess. It's not something we try not to we have a family, so we try not to work at the same time. But sometimes that doesn't work out. It's quite private. It's quite private. Yeah. It's not secretive. It's just that's what it is. And we both know that. So the door's closed to the office and someone's doing some studying. Yeah.
I guess
back at school.
Our final question is, do you have a favorite Daniel Craig moment on screen where you were watching it and maybe it caught you off guard, or you learned something about him as an actor you wouldn't have guessed from, you know, being married to him?
Well, Benoit Blanc in Knives Out and Glass Onion is like, I don't know where he came from. I've never met him. I've never met him around the house. So that's him and Rian Johnson cooked up that character. He's so funny. And so like, so interesting. Yes.
It's one of his definitive roles, I feel like, now. And I feel like did you introduce Daniel to Rian? Cause you were in Brothers Bloom, and you're fantastic in that film. I absolutely adore that film.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. No, I didn't. Rian reached out to Daniel when he'd written, Knives Out, and offered him the part. I didn't introduce them, but Rian is talk about an imagination, you know, because he has so much like wit and humor, and then he loves that intricate. I mean, Brothers Bloom had it too, and the, you know, the intricate plot that's like a wind up puzzle box that has to slowly unravel. He's so brilliant, Rian. But yeah, I think they love working together.
Also, that's the kind of guy you can sit and talk about Bette Davis with for a couple hours. Like Rian Johnson, just obsessed with movies.
Yes, he's one of the most knowledgeable people. Have you met him on the show? On
your
show?
Yes, yes.
Yeah. Oh, he's brilliant, right? Just brilliant, yeah.
So much fun, yeah.
Someone who reads murder mysteries, like for fun, like is someone you want to talk to.
Yeah, he's a clever guy.
Thank you so much for being here. My God, one of the few truths about, you know, cinema going forward is, like, you know, in the future, we don't know what we're going to get, but when there's a new Rachel Weisz project, we will be watching it. That is absolutely, like, on the docket every time.
Oh, well, thank you. That's very honored. Thank you.
Yes, this series is truly, truly fantastic. And I'm not, like, just saying this because you're here. I was saying it to Lewis. I was saying it to friends last night at the premiere. People who had seen the full series were telling me, like, I'm going to enjoy the rest of it. It is truly a mind fuck of a series. When you watch it, listeners, when you watch it, like, you're just going to be taking it in and you'll be like, what is going on? But at the center of it is you with such an incredible, incredible performance.
Thank you. Well, we hope it's Alice and I hope it's a ride. And as I said, it begins in this kind of very grounded place, and then it gets more and more heightened, and it gets into beyond what you've seen. It gets into the world of not sci-fi, but near-fi. So it's sort of science fiction that's just almost within our reach scientifically. And it gets pretty operatic and it gets quite bananas.
I'm going to describe the world Ira and I inhabit as near-fi. So I think I think we're on board.
So. Thank you so much.
Thanks again
for being here with us. Yeah.
Thank you so much. I wish we were closer on the Zoom box, but
yes, I got to see you in person at the premiere. You know, from a distance, you just were so wonderful. So
thank you so much.
All right.
See you later.
Bye.
See
you later. Take care.
Bye.
After talking with Rachel Weisz, we realized that this is too big of a gift for one segment. So we're going to give you a couple extra doses of Weisz and talk about a couple of her projects that we have not seen before. Now, Lewis.
Yes.
You watched About a Boy with Hugh Grant, my man.
Yes.
I love
our
him.
Man.
I love him. So, by the way, just before, we didn't mention this in the what we've been watching segment. I just saw Hugh Grant in Dungeons and Dragons, Honor Among Thieves, and he's so fun in that. And it's like, it's such a contrast to people being like, he was being a dick on the red carpet, he wasn't having fun, etc. And we've already discussed that, but it was just like, when Hugh Grant is having fun, he is having fun.
Oh,
and
yeah.
He and Chris Pine, and even Michelle Rodriguez is so just fun to watch in this. And then, of course, Justice Smith is in it. And we need a starring role for him immediately.
I was also going to say about Hugh Grant that once upon a time, I used to do a segment for MovieLine.com called My Favorite Scene, where we would ask people what their favorite movie scene was. Routinely, men would pick Hugh Grant dancing in Love Actually. Like, there's something about Hugh Grant that speaks to, I think, men in general, but he's just so fucking fun. I think he's somebody who is self-serious because he is also, the talent is just on tap. He's amazing. And you can't keep your eyes up in every movie. Like, Four Weddings and a Funeral is a classic because of Hugh Grant. I talk about Impromptu all the time on this, but that movie too. And in About a Boy, man, again, he plays a character, first of all, that I don't see a lot of, which is, first, he's just a rich, well-off person whose dad has sold a successful Christmas single in the 50s, and he's living off the royalties from that. And he is unapologetically still just a lout. Somebody who is just like walking around, has no job. He does lie to a couple of women and says he has a kid to, you know, woo them or whatever. But just like a single, good-looking guy, probably 40 or so. And like, can we just see more of those? I would just like to. They don't even have to be funny. I don't care. But he is so winning throughout this movie. And by the way, it's just crazy that there are two Nicholas Hoult, Rachel Weisz movies, and they are About a Boy and The Favorite.
I like that you mentioned that he's just sort of like has this money and just sort of gets to hang around, because I feel like some of the best movies are when, you know, shout out to Nepo Babies and, you know, intergenerational wealth or whatever. But some of the best movies are people where, like, they don't really have a defined job. They just have money and they're hanging around and you just get to see the story.
Yeah, right. Just, yeah, we want something nice to look at. You know what I'm saying? We want the house to look like The Sims Live in Large. We want to see the fun things.
Nick Hornby's work is sort of like, I feel like, proto-male Nancy Myers. Or Nora Ephron-esque, you know?
Right.
Mm-hmm. About a Boy is definitely that. High Fidelity also sort of like that, except he's working at a record store, but also working at a record store and still has money. So, you know.
Also, this movie points out to me just the extremely weird track we have put Toni Collette on. Nowadays, you would only put Toni Collette basically as the lead in something. I know she was like a minor character in Knives Out, but that's like a pretty rare Toni Collette role these days. Once upon a time, it's like when you realize Frances McDormand plays the sister in Something's Gotta Give. It's like, what? Mm-hmm. Like, you took that? Like, you have like six lines or whatever. Obviously, she's great in many supporting roles, like Almost Famous, whatever. But Toni Collette in this movie is a hippie type who has lots of, she's very disturbed and potentially suicidal, which seems utterly too dark for a movie like this. And yet, because it's Hugh Grant who has a bleakness to his humor, it ends up working out. I don't know. I never questioned it.
I will say in this movie, Rachel is on my list because she's at that dinner party scene. She's like, I just think all hip-hop sounds the same to me.
Oh, excuse me. Somebody at the table says to her, and they don't explore the conversation, East Coast or West Coast rap? Who just throws that out? Who throws that out?
That's such a like a Nick Hornby script. It's like, yeah, that's in the scene she's sitting there and Hugh Grant is, you know, chatting her up. And the off-screen conversation is the most interesting part of the scene.
Yeah. White people popping off.
Did you like the film overall?
Yes. I will. I think it started better than it ended because it ends somewhat conventionally with a scene where Hugh Grant is helping out Nicholas Hoult perform during a talent show. And, you know, they're about to boo him and he comes in and accompanies him. It feels very familiar. But both of their performances throughout the movie, what a great kid performance from Nicholas Hoult, who is, I think, about 11 or 12 in that movie. And it's nice to see, you think of Hugh Grant as somebody whose humor in films comes from the fact that he's this dignified adult actor. But to watch a kid really match him tit for tat and be just as, not just deadpan, but self-assured is really cool to see. I can't think of another movie like that where a kid and an adult, you know, like maybe like Paper Moon or something. That's a movie where you're really disarmed by what a good actor Tatum O'Neal is.
Mm-hmm. That Natalie Leon, the professional, is it Natalie Portman?
Oh, yes.
In that? Yeah, when they're killing bitches. she holds her own in that.
The first great Natalie Portman performance, yes. Though, as you know, I don't really stand her, which makes me not like the other gays.
All right, bitch.
Yeah.
I'd forgotten that. Now, Nicholas Hoult was the lead in that, too. And he is one of my favorite, you know, actors, to be honest. He was doing a lot of work in The Menu to make it watchable.
I was overserved by Nicholas Hoult in The Menu. You know what I'm saying? I'm like Gene Shalit now. I write puns. he was good, but I thought that movie was all about Janet McTeer. I thought she was the best in that movie.
All right, so the film that I watched was The Constant Gardener.
Which is an interesting movie to pick because, one, obviously Rachel Weisz won an Oscar for it, but two, she really stomped to victory with that performance. She won most of the precursors, and now we never talk about that movie.
Well, here's the thing. I get why we never talk about it, because it feels very much like an Oscar film.
Yeah, right.
It's, you know, it's one of those heightened thriller films that is also about politics and what's going on in the world. And so the thriller element is there, but it's a lot of people talking about, you know, like, other things that seem very much like, okay, this is a thriller for adults, you know, but smart adults. You know, there's no Ivanovich shit going on here. Okay.
Right. I mean, that is sort of a genre of the time. It's very Blood Diamond or something.
Yes.
You know?
I mean, that at least is more campy than The Constant Gardener.
Yeah.
Leonardo DiCaprio is doing entirely too much in Blood Diamond.
Yes. No. As I've said, my favorite Leonardo DiCaprio performance remains Django Unchained, because we actually made him play a character in that and not just a rich, mean person. There was something else going on there that was exciting. And we didn't even nominate him for that. So strange. Anyway, what did you think of Rachel in The Constant Gardener?
I thought she's so fucking good. You know, as I mentioned to her before, you know, she it's sort of like the opposite of some of the wicked characters that she plays, which doesn't mean that she's, you know, like sweet and meek by any means. I didn't want that to come across when I was when we were talking to her. But because the character, you know, takes the role of, you know, a dead wife that could just be dry as hell. If she'd got nominated for like a boring version of this wife, like it would have been a bit like Claire Foy in The First Man. You know, that was sort of one of the most recent like wife roles where I was like, what are we doing here?
Right.
But Rachel has so much to do in this film, you know, from when she meets him, when she meets Ralph Fiennes, in that sort of scene that she interrupts, where he's giving a speech, you know, about Iraq and everything, and then, you know, she gets to play the international intrigue of it all. You know, she gets to play losing her child. You know, there's so much meat in this role for her to play, and she's only in about like 45% of the film.
Also, Ralph Fiennes pops up quite often. Not like, you know, it'd be weird if a year went by and you didn't get Ralph Fiennes. We just talked about The Menu, but I still feel like we're due for like a proper Ralph Fiennes appreciation moment. I mean, he's nominated for a couple Oscars. Obviously, he is bone chilling in Schindler's List. Great in The English Patient, a movie that I would describe now as underappreciated. Like Seinfeld erased what was at the time like a groundswell of support for that movie. Juliette Binoche, of course, one of our fabulous best actors too. But Ralph Fiennes in general, there's just like something so watchable about like the glassiness of his stare, and like you can just see the layers of an intelligent personality there, which is really on screen in Quiz Show, where he plays a Charles Van Doren, who was at the time a Time magazine covering sensation, who goes on a game show, wins a whole bunch of times, and the big secret is the game is rigged. And he's basically chosen by the producers as a successor to Herbert Stemple, played by John Turturro, since Ralph Fiennes is more watchable and alluring as a TV presence. But that remains one of my favorite movies.
I love Quiz Show. And I also think that, he hasn't gotten that much real awards attention, except for like the Golden Globe nomination for The Menu, probably since maybe the Grand Budapest Hotel.
Right. And it wasn't really about him either. He was just part of a giant, you know, Wes Anderson style ensemble there.
But I really do love Ralph Fiennes. And I feel like
The End of the Affair, so good.
Yeah. It is still so weird to me, though, seeing him on screen with J-Lo.
Weirder pairings.
That is a weird ass pairing. Okay, every time he's in Made in Manhattan, I'm like, he's gonna kill her.
Yeah, most of the people she's with have a kind of like, I don't know, down home vibe, shall we say. You know, Ben Affleck you can hang with, whereas nothing about him is casual even in the slightest.
I thought he was great in the film, obviously, but what I really loved was seeing Archie Panjabi in this film.
Right. Archie Panjabi's... By the way, what are we doing with her? Where is
nothing,
she?
Nothing, okay?
Juliana vaporized her. I don't know what happened. Yeah.
She put a fatwa on her, okay? Yeah. Archie Panjabi has not been seen in anything since that split screen in The Good Wife.
Right. I remember her in that Gillian Anderson show, The Fall, for a split second. Otherwise, this is an Emmy winner. It's like Anna Gunn syndrome. What did we do with Anna Gunn?
And she pops up in the film, and the way she pops up in the movie, it's really just, sorry, and the way she pops up in the movie, it's like, why aren't we seeing more of this actress in film?
Yeah.
Like, she's so commanding on screen and, like, really holds her own with Ray. And, like, they have, like, great screen chemistry together. So it's just like, where is she?
Now I will not be able to let this question go. What a disturbing problem we have. You would think there would be roles aplenty for her, too. I don't understand.
Yeah. Although I will say Ralph Fiennes may or may not have said that he couldn't understand the vitriol directed at J.K. Rowling. But this was in 2021.
All right. You think he's done some reading since then? The British disappoint me.
I feel like she's only become more disfigured spiritually as a human being since then. So maybe like being around her, you know, I don't know, like the face is crumbling and whatever.
Right.
Phantom of the Opera mask that she has on, you know, to make her still seem human, is cracking or something. You know, I feel like in 2021, where she was sort of being, you know, like an enfant terrible, to now 2023, where she's like a full like Milo Yiannopoulos. Like it's that someone's opinion would have changed, you know?
Yeah. I do not mean to make light of the fact that she stands for something so vile now and says vile things, believes vile things. But it really did come on, I don't want to say slowly. Once upon a time it was, oh, she's following a couple of dubious accounts on Twitter. Oh, she's retweeting a couple of dubious people. And now it's where it is, where she's just the TERF, number one ranked fucking TERF. It's so wretched. It's so wretched.
Lewis, I'm going to let you finish, but I've got a lot more to say about J.K. Rowling when we get to the Keep It segment.
Oh, all right. All right, let's get there. Let's get there.
All right. We will be right back with Keep It. And we're back with our favorite segment of the episode. It's Keep It. Lewis, what year is your Keep It from?
I swear it's from 2023, but in a way also 1988, because let me tell you, it involves Tracy Chapman. Luke Combs, who that's not somebody in my wheelhouse at all, covered Fast Car by Tracy Chapman. It sounds great. I love this cover. And my Keep It goes to actually all songs that aren't this cover, because you know what he does in this song? Mm. He keeps the lyric, "Now I work in the market as a checkout girl." And maybe that's just shocking to me because, you know, the tone of Luke Combs' voice is very villain in Boys Don't Cry. So it's shocking that he can, you know, make such a bold choice. But then I realized, like, how for years and years have we had so many covers of like women's songs where they have to, where men change the pronouns or whatever? It's like, no, it's their fucking song. Like, just sing it as is. It's like there's always been a weird pride issue with owning femininity from the perspective of the person singing the song. I'm reminded of Once Upon a Time. One of my favorite covers of all time is Natalie Cole's cover of Pink Cadillac by Bruce Springsteen. And at the time, he did not want her to do that song. And his quote, I don't know if this came out only after the fact, but his quote was, "It's not a girl's song." And to me, that's one of the few things Bruce Springsteen has ever said that I find a little, I don't know about upsetting, but jarring. Like, I didn't expect mm-hmm. that from him. And I don't know. I think it's just so lovely to hear a guy sing a song as it was intended in the first place and not needing to turn it into his story. I was pleased by it. And also kind of to say in general, I think Fast Car is one of the few songs, particularly 80s songs, that has not aged a single day. Nothing about the production on that song sounds like it belongs necessarily to the era of like Motley Crue or Bon Jovi or whatever was happening at the time. It just keeps gaining. Like, there's no like pop culture reference in the song that makes you think, oh, it's definitely from this one time. I'm just shocked by how singular that song remains. I'm now thinking of Marnie, quote unquote, covering it in Girls on the last episode.
I mean, listen, it's a bit because technology hasn't caught up to where it's supposed to be. We're supposed to be living like the Jetsons, you know?
Yes,
so
right.
cars are still fast, right. But we're still driving them.
That's true. Right. They're not all self-driving, et cetera. Right.
Well, you know what the keeping the checkout girl line reminds me of? Do you remember the single by the group, the indie rock group, Black Kids, "I'm Not Gonna Teach Your Boyfriend How to Dance With You"?
I don't know this song.
It's like from 2008. It was like a pretty popular song, but it was like, it had like the chorus, "You're the girl that I've been dreaming of ever since I was a little girl." And it was like an inside joke between him and his sister that they always used to say, "ever since I was a little girl," since they were kids. But it was, that was always, like a line that stuck out to me on the radio when I first heard it. Because I was like, is this a cover? No, it's just the original song. And it's funny to them. So,
by the way, I think just as a challenge in general, I think more songs should have the line, "Now I work in the market as a checkout girl." I just like, if in Stairway to Heaven, he just said, "Now I work in the market as a checkout girl," I would be a huge fan of that song.
I think we might even be moving to that. Because I feel like the way that straight people appropriate gay slang, I have definitely had at least And not like, you know, like one of our straight friends who like hangs out with gays a lot. I mean, like I've heard from other random like straight guys where they will just say like girl sometimes. And I'm like, are they starting to pick up on that?
That both worries me and thrills me because it is funny in general to refer to somebody as girl or a thing as girl.
Can you imagine like a very straight man like being mad at you or like you're in high school and like they're bullying you, but they're like using your slang now. They're like, where you going, sis?
That's tough. Wow. Interesting. I will say at work where I'm surrounded mainly by straight people, I will casually just call them girl, or if I know them really well, maybe the F word, which is funny due to a straight person.
All right. So my keep it this week, I teased it a bit when we talked about J.K. Rowling, but
yes,
it has been rumored now that HBO is developing a series based on the Harry Potter books, where each season of the show would be represented by a different book. And what I have to say to that is enough.
Oh my God. It also just feels like there's six IP objects out there that we are tapping again and again.
The exact same ones.
Like Resources and Settlers of Catan. Yes.
What would a TV series of Harry Potter add to the canon that we do not already have, except for a bunch more money for HBO?
You're really getting to the heart of the industry right now. It really is all about money, it feels like. I don't know. I've never had that feeling until right now.
But what I do have to say about it is you can already foresee what would happen from a Harry Potter TV series. It would include, one, whoever's writing it and creating it is going to have to do so much press about the fact that J.K. Rowling is
who she is,
a literal demon from the Hellmouth now.
Yeah.
And so you're going to have to talk about that constantly and explain why you're working on a series that's putting money into her pocket.
Yes, right.
And then all the people who've been calling out J.K. Rowling for being a TERF, you know, and like just for generally being awful, y'all going to start watching and live tweeting the show? Because you know it'll happen.
Right. I am always surprised to see people. I mean, I'm trying to even think of a comparison. It's not like I'm out there being like, God, you know what single still slaps? Beat It. Like, I'm just, it's not important for me to announce that I'm still a fan of somebody who is so, you know, wretched. But people really are out there being like, oh, talking about Harry Potter all the time, even though the conversation, if you're having an honest one, should go to what the fuck is wrong with this woman?
Yeah. So I don't want to see it. HBO's weirdly, like, consistently been great. They've had off moments, but I feel like a Harry Potter series is not going to add anything to the HBO sort of prestige, you know?
Just invent some other goddamn wizard, can't you? There ain't nothing special about Harry.
Or, I mean, like, except for, like, the Game of Thrones thing, which, by the way, like, at least felt fresh because it was just coming from a book which hadn't been adapted yet. HBO's done really well with, like, sort of, like, original material. You know, without sort of, or even if it's source material, you know, something like a Mildred Pierce, right? You know, like this just feels like Harry Potter is done to death. Let it go.
Yeah. I mean, it's up there with like a Spider-Man or something. Like, I swear to God, I understand the story of this teenager shooting things out of his hand. I get it now.
Okay. I mean, it's like a barista who just went through a breakup telling you to read Bell Hooks' is All About Love. Like, we get it.
Does that happen to you a lot?
It does.
You have better baristas than I do.
Anyway, that's our show this week.
Ooh, I'm going to go ahead and cool down from the Vice situation. Certain people should not be looking at lowly writers like us gabbing about projects.
I already feel a type of way about having to have her remember whether or not she spit in Rachel McAdams' mouth or Rachel McAdams spit in hers.
But no, she should have to think about that once a day. I disagree.
It's a good thing she does not have social media, by the way. I feel like there's like Rachel Weisz, Kate Blanchett fanfic online.
Oh, certainly. No, and Kate Blanchett's not online either. And for good fucking reason. She should be afraid of the queer community.
I feel like Kate Blanchett more than Rachel sees it.
Yeah. Well, she's definitely been, reporters definitely ask her about it all the time, yeah, too.
Kate seems like the kind of person who's like, you're hanging out with her and she sees you like scrolling Instagram or Twitter or something. She's probably like, let me see your phone for a minute. And like, we'll scroll through it and be like, oh, that's what's going on here.
Now we're writing Kate Blanchett fanfic. See, watch us.
It is so weird they have not been in a film together.
That is fucking bizarre. Can they spar? I want there to be an actual duel, like Madonna versus Madonna in the Die Another Day video.
I feel like dueling lesbians is a role you need to see.
And they're both so good at playing them. All right.
Yeah.
That's for the universe to figure out.
Yeah. All right. Thank you again to Rachel Weiss for joining us this week. And we'll see you next week for more Keep It. Don't forget to follow us at Crooked Media on Instagram and Twitter, and subscribe to Keep It on YouTube for access to full episodes and other exclusive content. Plus, if you're as opinionated as we are, consider dropping us a 5-star review on your podcast platform of choice. Keep It is a Crooked Media production. Our senior producer is Kendra James, our producer is Chris Lord, and our associate producer is Malcolm Whitfield. Our executive producers are Ira Madison III, that's me, and Louis Vertel. This episode was recorded and mixed by Evan Sutton. Thank you to our digital team, Matt DeGroot, Nar Malconian, and Delon Villanueva for production support every week. And as always, Keep It is filmed in front of a live studio audience.